Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Mark Jurgensmeyer, director of the Orfila Center for Global International Studies at the University of California Santa Barbara campus. Today we have a wonderful guest to discuss with us the whole field of international and area studies, where it's been, where it's going, how it's changed in an era of globalization. Ainsley Embry, who for many years was the chair of the history department at Columbia University, was dean of the School of International Affairs. He's one of the most prominent scholars in the country in the field of South Asian history and South Asian studies in general. He was in the U.S. Embassy in Delhi during the Carter administration. He's also taught at the School of Foreign Service. And the interesting thing about Ainsley is that his career has in some ways spanned the development of international and area studies in this country. So Ainsley, welcome to Santa Barbara.
Thank you.
Great pleasure to have you here. And what fun it's going to be to talk with you a little bit about yourself, your own career, and how that's interacted with the way international studies and area studies has developed this country. Because I know you're a young man. You certainly look like it.
Thank you.
The rumor is that you started teaching at Columbia in 1958.
Yes.
At a time, just after the beginning of the Cold War, right after World War II, when international studies as a field was just coming into being, and area studies focusing on the studies of different parts of the world were just coming into existence. And well, I think you had something to do with the creation of the Institute for Southern Asian Studies at Columbia. But when you came there, did anybody really care about area studies or international studies?
Nobody could have cared less, especially about South Asians, Indian studies. No, it is an interesting point. I had taught for 10 years in India, so I, in a way, came out of a international background and also a Canadian.
That is a different country, isn't it?
That is a different country, yes. It's an interesting point. When I came to Columbia in 1958, certainly there was nothing called Indian studies. I don't think they called it area studies. The only, because there was a China program, Japanese program, and Russian. That was the outside world.
They were important because of the godless commies. We had to study
that's
about
right.
them.
And Middle East mm-hmm. was also important.
Uh-huh.
South Asia was not important. It was not on the books. Mm-hmm. Certainly Indian studies mm-hmm. was not on the books.
So were you invited to teach in South Asian studies, or was this just a coincidence?
There's a double coincidence. The Middle East Institute, dealing with the Middle East, of course, and Islamic things, had thought that Pakistan should be added to the Middle East in some way. But there's no chance of getting somebody hired to teach Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
So they had the happy thought. Actually, it was Jack Barson, and the happy thought, get somebody to teach India, could do all that funny area.
Right.
And some of them knew who I was. I'd done my work at Columbia. And so the idea was to get somebody who could do a touch on Pakistan as well as India. But the other thing that was important at this time was the development at Columbia. It had long had what was called contemporary civilization, which meant, of course, the Western world.
Oh, so these people must have felt threatened that you were coming in and teaching some other kind of civilization.
Yes, it was to bring me in along with the people interested in the Middle East Institute were Ted DeBerry and Jack Barson, who had begun to be interested that should other civilizations be added? Should there be recognition that there are other civilizations in the West?
And this was a controversy. I mean, the idea was, if you're going to teach civilizations, and of course Columbia University has had this great program in civilizations as the basis of its undergraduate curriculum.
And it was the basis, so why add these funny foreign countries?
Right, and wasn't there what Alan Bloom was talking about, the closing of the American mind? He's very concerned about Western civilization not being taught properly.
Alan Bloom is interesting. He wrote this book that every academic dreams of writing a book that would sell the way Alan Bloom's did. I regret to say I bought it, added to his royalties. He was one of the most prominent people denouncing what he called foreign area studies. that our job is to teach students about our own culture.
And our own culture meant European culture.
Yeah, European culture. That, I mean, very much our culture. And Alan Bloom said one of the troubles was that we're teaching students relativism. This person he used as an example was a very famous person at Columbia, Margaret Mead. He referred to her as a sexual adventuress who went around the world sampling foreign cultures and then coming and teaching students that there was no truth. You took what you want. He said it was all right to learn about foreign cultures, but Mead and her life and her ilk actually suggested we could learn from foreign cultures. That was the objection of a lot of people.
So the idea that Asian cultures, Chinese, India, Middle Eastern, was a part of our own cultural heritage simply didn't enter their minds.
It's an interesting point. It didn't enter their mind partly because there were very few at the undergraduate level. There were no Indians studying at Columbia as undergraduates at that time. Maybe a few Chinese. No, there was no thought that there were students in our classes, nor was there any suggestion that it might be useful to know something about China and India. Japan was a little different because we had been at war with Japan. So that was...
Well, that's what I was going to get at. I mean, then why did it persist? I mean, how did the study of these other cultures develop at all? And was it... in part for the reason that you just implied, the political ones. I mean, after all, World War II is over. We just fought a war involving Asian countries. We're now responsible for the overseeing some of the former Japanese as well as European territorial holdings. And now we're engaged in a new Cold War with the godless commies that included China as well as Russia. And in the Third World was kind of caught between, where there's a consciousness that we had to know about them to try to lure them on our side.
It's an interesting point.
Was this political context?
No, anymore. Certainly, nobody would have read the books. There were conferences held at that time, precisely. One of the very best was held, sponsored by Milton Singer, who was at the University of Chicago, and Ted DeBerry at Columbia. The best one, I think, was on India, where this question... why do we want our undergraduates to know about countries, India, China, and so on? The answer they gave would not be acceptable now. They said in their proposal, it will deepen our students' knowledge of their own society to learn about other cultures. I think this would not be considered...
their own, of course, again, meaning European society.
And they emphasized that the value of study with China or India was it would... give you more sense of what your own culture is about, which I think is true.
But let's get to a very important point, and that is funding. we academics like to pretend that money has no role to play in the way things develop. But isn't it true that at the time, maybe not in 1958, but shortly after, wasn't the Ford Foundation and then government funds available for the study of other cultures?
This is an interesting point, which many people... you suggest academics are very poor, very pure. They don't like to mention money.
Right.
People like DeBerry at Columbia, Singer at the University of Chicago, wanted to stress the cultural value. But then there was the other people more, and no, these people were realistic too, was the idea of the National Defense Language Program. The idea that one reason we had to learn something about language was we might be at war with these people.
It put me through a graduate school. I studied Hindi, studied about India, and that was the way I made my money. I got grants.
Well, the university was filled with people, and I had to do a little bit because I never got any. I helped spend it.
Right.
But, Hindi was a good example. Yeah. We could argue certainly we might be at war with China, Russia, Middle East languages.
Right.
But India was difficult. Nobody thought we'd ever be at war with India. We didn't do any business with India.
But it was part of the Third World. Krishna Menon and Nehru were seeming to be playing footsie with the Soviets. Wasn't there the idea that we had to know about them in order to try to seduce them over
there? You see, you mentioned an interesting name. Krishna Menon was a friend of mine.
Oh.
And he came to Columbia, and he wanted to speak. He had just made the statement that Israel should be pushed into the sea. And I tried to...
Didn't go over very big
well,
at Columbia even at the time.
I tried to tell Krishna that I didn't think I could arrange for him to speak. He was very insistent.
He was the Ahmadinejad at his time at Columbia.
And he spoke. First question that was asked by a student in the audience, did you say that Israel... His answer was, do you believe everything you read in the newspapers? And switched it to Vietnam. And said how awful the Americans were about Vietnam. The audience, of course, these old days, cheered him to the roof. And it was part of this whole very different world.
But how did you get the money and also the academic to support to start the Institute for Southern Asian Studies at Columbia? And were there other...
Mark, you're asking a very academic question, because I got it by writing proposals. And some people who read my proposals questioned the authenticity of my facts and figures. For example, one very prominent man looked at my figures and said, you put down there are 200 people studying South Asia at Columbia.
We still do that, Ainsley. We're trying to get grants.
He said, how did you get this money? And I explained that there were 10 courses. But he said, they're all the same 10 people studying.
It's true, and, I'm sure.
I tried to explain that we didn't get a grant unless we... He said, you know, if you were a businessman, you'd be in jail.
That's probably right.
But that is the answer.
But who gave the grants? Who did you go...
We got money all together from South Asia and the Ford Foundation.
Ford Foundation.
One has to remember that the Ford Foundation was the source of money for international studies.
But that's an interesting question then. Why would the Ford Foundation have this vision that somehow this was good for academia? Presumably they had America's interest in mind or somebody's interest. What do you think was behind that?
What behind it was, I think, again, a very genuine impulse. The Ford established a program, perhaps you had, others profited by, all the prominent scholars now in Asian studies, the older generation, profited by the Ford Foundation program because they had the idea that if you're going to study political science or whatever, you should know the language, you should know something about the culture, that it wasn't just enough to read books about Indian politics, who's in and who...
So you think they were not solely motivated by political...
No, I don't
concerns.
Think the Ford Foundation was.
But that the government got in the act.
The government got in the act, and the only way you could persuade Congress to give money to study, even Chinese, but Hindi, other... the African languages. What use was studying African languages? The argument was, unless we know these languages... we're weakening our defense.
Security. Posture. Yeah, but after all, it was the national defense.
It was that's right. It was the national defense
reasons,
language.
For defense reasons, supposedly, people like me should study Hindi.
And the Ford Foundation didn't have defense. Mm-hmm. They had foreign cultures. Mm-hmm. They emphasized that whatever field you went into, you should know the language and the culture. Mm-hmm. Now, this may seem a fairly commonplace idea. It was not commonplace in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Why would you need to know an Indian language to know about Indian politics?
Well,
why would you need to know Chinese?
In the disciplines, like in political science, for example, if you had to study a language, it certainly complicated there.
It complicated your life.
Right.
And furthermore, if you're going to study about the communists in China, why would you need to know about Confucius?
Right. And but also, wasn't there the sense that if you didn't approach a study of another culture with a disciplinary rigor and methodological rigor, area studies was really a kind of intellectual tourism. You know, it was a...
Well, I remember one story of the Ford Foundation program. A young man who had applied, a very famous political scientist, but he asked the young man, applying for India program, are you interested in Indian architecture, art, dance? And the young man said, I'm studying political science, not that sort of thing. I'm happy to say he didn't get the...
Oh, good. Well, this explains a little bit about the development of South Asia and other area studies, but you were also involved in international studies, and that has also taken an interesting trajectory, the change of international, the Columbia School of International Affairs, which you were the dean for a while, is one of the most distinguished such programs in the world. But it started really for training diplomats, right?
The International School of International Affairs started as international, just as at Columbia College, mm-hmm. civilization meant the West, mm-hmm. international studies meant America-centered, of course, mm-hmm. European and Russian. Mm-hmm. It didn't at first go beyond that. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not that these people were warmongers, but I think you made the interesting comment.
This is in the context
we have
of
to be
war.
Interested as scholars in money.
Yeah.
And there was money
that was
for Russian
that's
studies.
Where the money was. It was the Cold War. Was. We were concerned about the godless commies.
We could get chairs in Russian studies. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get chairs in South Asian studies. We could get chairs in Chinese studies. Mm-hmm. Now, it was very, international studies were very much security studies. Mm-hmm. I heard the president yesterday mentioning the same thing about knowing about Latin America. It involves our security. Now, we tried to say you might be interested in Latin America for other than mm-hmm. security reasons. Mm-hmm. But international affairs, I think it's fair to say, there was great tension about this because the people interested in international affairs felt it was a waste of money to move off to what they called area studies. I don't think you mentioned the word, mm-hmm. but area studies meant not just studying international relations, mm-hmm. but the point I'm making, studying language, culture.
But international affairs programs today are really quite different. I think the number of people, as I understand it, and even at Columbia, that are interested in security issues, who want to work with the government, are in the minority, maybe 30%. And over half of the students want to go into business, international finance, something
yes.
of that nature.
Okay.
The other 20% in journalism, global international journalism, in NGOs, the international civil society field. So when did all of that begin to change, and the security and diplomacy part, which was the reason for founding these programs, diminish and business and journalism and international NGOs began to come to the fore as the fields that students were interested in?
Now you raise another ticklish subject. The reason why it shifted partly was there were no jobs in the Foreign Service. Hmm. When it started, this whole movement in the 50s.
I see, it started up during the the Cold War.
Even before that, after the war, mm-hmm. there was a recognition we need diplomats who know languages and so on. Mm-hmm. It soon became apparent that many people were not needed in our Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. And
initially, they needed a lot because they were trying to develop every embassy had an American library, it had cultural affairs and
that
all
was,
these things that you were involved with when you
yes,
were in India. Now it's been closed down for security reasons.
That has all been finished now
right.
for security reasons.
Right.
We had some of the best, for example, yeah. the library in India was right. the best in Asia.
Right.
But the answer was, in the new generation, what's that for? What
right,
use
right.
is it?
But the shift, event,
the shift came because I think it became obvious that, now business is a good example. Mm-hmm. Our students saw Japanese studies. There was a double thing in Japanese studies. Mm-hmm. Lots of business, both ways. Mm-hmm. But also the Japanese were not good at English. Mm-hmm. So we needed people who could speak Japanese. This
right.
was great.
Right.
It was also true in China. Mm-hmm. It wasn't true in Indian studies. You don't really need to know Indian languages to do business in India. At least that was the argument.
Yeah.
So why put money mm-hmm. into these languages? Mm-hmm. The great language was African language. Why on earth support mm-hmm. African languages? Mm-hmm. And so the shift took place again. I think one has to recognize, you mentioned the Cold War, that was important, but also business interests.
Well, now this was a shift in international studies, but in area studies, there was at one time there was a kind of, first of all, there was a missionary bulge.
Oh.
That is, people who had a missionary church background. But then there was a Peace Corps bulge. After, in the mid-60s, when students came back from the Peace Corps, then development was a big issue. I remember when I was first involved in in South Asia studies, I'd say the majority of the students were involved in development issues. They were interested in trying to find ways of economically developing and provide social development for India. And then, in the late 60s and 70s, the hippies came in, and suddenly it was culture. Everybody was interested in religion and Hare Krishna and all of this sort of thing.
You know, you have mentioned the word that is not mentioned in academic circles,
which is?
And that is the influence of the missionary movement on all this. The only interest in the 19th century in this country, in countries like China especially, was from the missionary movement. Mm-hmm. The only place one heard of China especially was in churches, people coming back. And in the early days, the people who went into what we now call area studies were either missionaries or the children of missionaries. Mm-hmm. Now that disappeared, and I'll come back in a moment.
Or in my case, the nephew of missionaries.
Oh, some,
that's
a
how
connection.
I first heard about the rest of the world.
You heard about the rest of the world mm-hmm. in church. Mm-hmm. And this became a curious interest, but it was there. And as I say, this is a kind of anti-religious thing.
Yeah, these were kids who were not then interested in area studies as an attempt to convert the world. They just had gotten an intellectual
interest because they knew funny things like language.
Right, exactly.
And now, the great shift comes, indeed, you mentioned the Peace Corps. Right. I once made the statement that the people who went to our School of International Affairs or went into the Peace Corps were the kind of young people, I had to say young men, obviously, for this reason, mm-hmm. they were the people who formerly went into the church, idealistic, going to change the world, going to bring about change. They no longer went into the church. They went into the Peace Corps, or they went into international
right.
studies.
Right.
Now, I think I could...
Idealists, young idealists.
Idealists, the kind of idealists you have at Santa Barbara. They, in the 19th century, went into the church. That's an avenue that young people were not closed to them, but wasn't interesting to them.
But then the hippies were a different kind of idealist.
Well, hippies are a different kind of idealist, but many of them went into the Peace Corps. Wasn't very anxious for some of the Peace Corps people, some of the hippie types. But there's no question, and I would argue this, and I think I could even document it, the people who went into the Peace Corps were indeed the people in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. I remember once in India, the train, an old gentleman saying to me, "I don't like the kind of missionaries you're sending to us now." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Why not?" He said, "These young missionaries you're sending now drink and smoke and chase girls. They're not like the old missionaries." He was speaking of the Peace Corps boys.
Of course, right.
But they were the same idealism uh-huh. that brought. And I think should play up the role of idealism.
Oh, I agree. But I think there is... maybe I shouldn't use the word hippie because that makes it sound as if these are people only into drugs and but there were a lot of in the late 60s and early 70s there were a lot of seekers, that is people who went to India because they were on a spiritual path, and India was famous around the world as being the home of spirituality, and it was a way of trying to discover yourself and so many people went there with this kind of personal interest and then became scholars. They began to learn the language. Often they kind of stopped seeking and they rejected the spiritual side, but continued then in the field of South Asian studies.
And well, you know,
even today, there are a lot of people who, faculty, who initially went to India because they were on a spiritual path.
A young man, no longer a young man, a more than middle-aged man, said to me recently, "I wish I hadn't known you when I went to India." He said, "When I went to India, I was only interested in two things, drugs and sex." And he said, if there had been anybody doing what sort of thing I was doing, it would have been different. I would have learned about other things. And he regretted his wasted years in India and Nepal.
But they were also interested in spirituality, at least at one point. And then these people became, in many cases, the bulwark of South Asia Studies program.
Yes.
And at that time, you know, really not talking about a time too long ago, there was no interest in India from a business point of view or a technological point of view. It was all because of culture. Now this brings us up to the present.
you're back to money a bit.
Uh-huh.
Now this was, I mentioned Japan. Japanese studies could get money. Mm-hmm. From people interested in business.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once I was trying to get money from a big pharmaceutical company, a very famous one, and the senior vice president gave me a half hour. And I thought, I better take my briefcase to carry the checks home. Mm-hmm. Why he gave me a half hour as the head of a pharmaceutical, famous one, that he said, one thing I would not give money to promote is Indian studies. He said, the Indians are crooks. They're stealing all our patents. They're manufacturing drugs and selling them at a tenth of the price that we're selling. That wouldn't get, and he said, if you want money for India to say, don't do Indian studies, I'd be glad to give you some. No, business was not interested in India. That's one of the enormous changes that have come over, is the interest of business.
And when did this begin to happen?
Oh, I think we can date it very clearly. The early 1990s, 1994, when India dropped its opposition to foreign investment. Many people are not aware that India did not allow foreign investment after 1947 independence.
Right. When I first went there, they didn't have Coca-Cola. They had Campa-Cola. They didn't have a 7-Up. They had this Thumbs Up.
They were very successful.
Yeah.
As competitors to Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm. Import substitution. They had their own cars.
A great business that went to India to start business was Enron in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And she was astonished at the hostility of Indians to foreign businesses. Mm-hmm. And she said, everywhere I go, they don't like multinationals. She said they fear some multinational that I never heard of. It couldn't have been any importance. I said, what was its name? She said, the East India Company, which, of course, took over India.
Right. It was.
And she said, these funny people
beginning of,
think we're like Western East economic. India Company, and they were, but that's
right.
No, India was very late in coming to investment, and they were envious of China's success.
And this, that was Manmohan Singh played a role?
Oh, he played a very vital role. Because he was a good economist. He knew all the economists in this country and elsewhere. But many famous economists now criticize Nehru for his policy of not permitting foreign investment, encouraging everything to be manufactured in India. I think one has to be fair to Nehru and said he, when he thought of development, he didn't think of just development in terms of increasing business production. He thought of the welfare of the country. Mm-hmm. Remember, India's in its preamble to the Constitution declares that India is a socialist, secular, democratic republic. Now, socialist meant other things.
And Nehru seemed to have an allergy against religion.
Yes. An allergy that many of us share in some ways, that secularism didn't mean anti-religion so much. But as Nehru once said, religion has been the curse of India. It has kept us from advancing, kept us from progress. We'll never become a successful country as long as we're hobbled by religion.
And quite different from Gandhi, of course, from this approach. poor Gandhi, if he had lived, would have been very disappointed indeed.
When Nehru was anti-religion, Gandhi once said something profoundly true. He said, people who say that religion has nothing to do with politics are only showing that they know nothing about either religion or politics.
Right.
And I think this is the other side that Nehru always missed, yes.
Yeah, we were talking the other night about how Gandhi, how disillusioned he was as an old man at the time of the partition of India and the riots between Muslims and Hindus. And he really had no future at that point.
Gandhi, that's the saddest episode of all. When India was becoming independent, a very close friend of mine went walking with him on that last tour, is that Gandhi was profoundly disappointed. But it also, he said, showed something about Gandhi and the changing world. What Gandhi kept repeating were lines from a Christian hymn. The night is dark, and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Yeah. Now, Not many people perhaps don't know where it comes from, but it's a Christian hymn. And that was the way that Gandhi felt. Hmm. The night was dark. Hmm. Everything that he had dreamed of seemed to be coming apart.
And then he was tragically killed, but if he had lived on, it would have been probably equally as tragic, because he would have seen in India, it was quite different than the one he envisioned.
Now, he would have seen, for example, the great things very important now in India, the nuclear deal between India and the United States. That is what is bringing, or they thought would bring India close to the United States, was that we would supply India with important nuclear technology. Now, India developed its nuclear weapons on its own, but it needs some technical things to really move further.
Well, now you've brought us to the politics, back to the politics of the present, where the issue with India, the interest in India these days, is not just business, which is certainly a great part of it, and technology, but also politics. Mm-hmm. And what do you make of this whole business of the kind of nuclear support? I mean, here the United States is currently paralyzed with fear about Iran getting a nuclear device, or North Korea, but it seems cheerfully to allow India and help it develop its own nuclear weapons capability. What do you make of that?
Pakistan is also our friend with nuclear capability, and no one ever mentions it.
Right.
It's an interesting point. The answer that Indians give, and that our own administration gives, is that India is not a nuclear threat. Mm-hmm. That it's true, India has the most sophisticated nuclear weapons. The poor Iranians would love to have what India has,
right,
but they don't. It's an interesting point. Very much involved with international relations, the politics, the international world. India is not felt to be a threat, where Iran is.
Well, now, when the BJP was in power, which of course is a kind of right-wing Hindu nationalist party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, it was the first one to explode a nuclear device and testing it. At that time, the United States didn't seem to be as cheerful about the idea and eager to support it. But now that the BJP is no longer in power, does the U.S. feel that this is a more useful kind of collaboration? What is the U.S. going to get out of this deal?
What is the U.S.? Some of us ask this. Some of us ask, what is India going to get out of it? What is the U.S. going to get out of it? What is the world? There is a small group, a man visiting Santa Barbara now, Mohanty. Mm-hmm. He is a member of a small...
It's Professor Mohanty from Delhi University.
Really,
he's teaching us. There
is a group in India, which he is one, and others, who are against the nuclear deal. They feel it is bad for India spending its money, the official explanation our administration gives, and the Indian administration gives, is that this will provide a source of energy. Now, people like Professor Mohanty and others know that nuclear power will never supply the bulk of fuel. That it's...
Well, obviously, there's a weapons capability.
It's
here.
A weapons capability.
That doesn't have anything to do with Pakistan, with the rise of Muslim extremism, the fear that Pakistan might possibly fall into the hands of militant Muslims, and then we would need weapons like this somehow.
Now, you have summarized international politics.
Right.
We think we can help India with its nuclear development.
Right.
We say it's for energy. Indians do, too. They know it's for development. More sophisticated weapons that will make them the undisputed power, the only one that even touches them, of course, in Asia is China.
Right.
So these are the politics of it. We think it will help against Islamic terrorism.
Yes. Well, you're mentioning something that no one in the policy field would say it out loud, and that is that the Indians, being a Hindu nation, is also anti-Muslim, as many Americans are. Now, have I said something a secret I'm not supposed to say out loud?
You said something you were supposed to say to me, but not in Washington.
Right.
It's one of the things.
But is that in truth? Is that
it's true? And I mentioned Professor Mohanty again. Mm-hmm. There are many Indians who feel as he do.
He does. Mm-hmm.
That this is feeding into the hands of Hindu nationalism. We're going to be a great power. We're going to have just as good weapons as the United States. Countries like Pakistan we can wipe out in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some, not many, and they'll never say it publicly, they see this, it's doing away with any threat from China,
mm-hmm.
that it makes us a great nation, and this is very important in international relations. Mm-hmm. The Indians will never say openly,
right.
that they're interested in it against China because they want to be friendly with China.
Right.
People here say it,
right.
but not in India.
Well, we're getting on issues of why international and area studies are of interest today, not only because of business, but because of the kind of security yes. reasons that you give. In a post-Cold War world, there's the new Cold War of the rise of Muslim radicalism that seems to obsess some people in Washington, and it gives Pakistan and India a new kind of role and a new kind of thinking about global politics. But isn't there also another element that's even closer to home? As you look out over the sea of students who take courses in India studies, for example, I remember when I first started teaching, one could sort of confidently talk about us and them. And now as you look out over the sea of students, there's more them than us. And if you're talking about this in kind of European ethnocentric terms, the wonderful richness of American culture that has become even more diversified in the last 20 years, and the large number of Asian students now in the diaspora of cultures in a global demography now means that everyone lives every place. And India studies increasingly in this country, South Asian studies, is taken up and not only studied, there's not only the students, but also the professors are increasingly themselves of South Asian heritage. Have you observed this? And this is a good
I observe it with some misgiving.
Yeah, all right. Because you think it's making ethnic studies out of South Asia.
Making ethnic studies. Mm. I taught at Brown University after I retired, and I was listed as teaching in ethnic studies.
Because you taught South Asian studies.
Because South Asian studies.
Yeah.
It was something that's profoundly important. I've been in about six classes here, big classes. I'm always amazed how large your classes are.
Mm-hmm. It's a state university,
I haven't heard a mention of what you mentioned at the beginning, the interest in spirituality.
Right.
I know the students are in your religious groups. Mm. But I think that
they're interested in religion, they're interested in, but not necessarily personally on his
personal
spiritual path.
I don't know anything to that at all, especially from the students in the diaspora,
mm-hmm.
the Indian students,
mm-hmm.
The Muslim students.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little embarrassed mm-hmm. when we talk about religion. They're like our own.
Right.
They're
like our own students who are not interested in religion.
Not interested in religion. At least...
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that we don't very much talk about, is the changing nature mm-hmm. of the student body.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who remember the Vietnam era, and the real concern of the students. Now it's easy to say it's because the young men were likely to be drafted. I think that was true, but there's also a really, I think, a humanistic concern of what we were doing to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe one finds that among students now.
The same kind of political passion.
I was interested that I've only met one student here, in this very liberal college, who showed any concern about what's happening in Tibet.
Mm.
As far as I know, he's the only one going.
Going to the protests in San Francisco
yes.
and being a part of the...
During the Vietnam War,
protests against
there
the Chinese.
Busloads of students going to protest this.
Mm.
And we know the reason. Our administration wants to be friendly to China.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be friendly to India.
Mm-hmm.
Now, no American, you know, the President Bush was the first American president who ever agreed to meet the Dalai Lama, which for a whole variety of reasons. But there was always the fear of offending
the Chinese,
Chinese.
All, a very important trade partner, a very important world
affairs. The Indians are afraid of offending the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
They're not at all favoring protesting against what's going on in Tibet.
Now, we started off the string of conversation talking about the ethnic makeup
yes.
of classes, and then you started talking about how we are missing some of these dimensions
yes.
of what's happening in South Asia studies. And I assume you're not against ethnic studies as such,
I'm not enthusiastic for them.
That's by, you may or may not be. I'm enthusiastic. I think it's a great idea. But what you're saying is that there are different, there should be Asian American ethnic studies classes, and there also then should be what you think of as a more classical interest in South Asia as a subject of study regardless of your ethnicity. Is that the point that you're
making? A pious old Indian once said to me, are there any, he said, I suppose there are Indian students at Columbia. And I said, hundreds. Mm-hmm. He said, I suppose they're all studying Indian religion and philosophy. I said, they're all studying economics or computer science. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, nobody's studying religion and philosophy.
But they do, some of them come to the courses in South Asia.
They do that because their fathers tell them that they should learn something about their culture.
Right.
I've been told this many times.
Right.
They've also told me their fathers had told them, there's no money to be made in this academic line, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, is there, it raises an interesting question. Is there a future for area studies in an era of globalization? I mean, after all, area studies, emerged in a very political context not that long ago. It's only been a few decades. It certainly changed radically in those 40, 50 years, as we've just now been discussing. International studies, also the whole idea that you conceive of the world as between nations, is now becoming global studies as we see the world differently. Is there still room for this kind of particularity of the study of cultures when now cultures themselves are no longer particular in the sense of only being in one geographic space? They're all over the planet.
One of the reasons I'm interested in Santa Barbara is your globalization emphasis. Mm-hmm. It's possible that is where I never called it area studies, but what other people call it, in a derogatory way. People in political science, especially, at many universities, including Columbia and elsewhere, political scientists who are not area people were opposed to what they called area studies, took people away from this serious scientific study of politics. Mm-hmm. Now, it strikes me what's happening in globalization may be a very interesting shift. Mm-hmm. That it'll be possible to see an interest outside the specific things like religion, this language, and so on, in a much broader way. I don't know quite how it'll move, and I've been asking your students, the only ones I've met in global studies, and they do seem to realize you can't do global studies without knowing language any more than some of us are old-timers, always insisted.
Mm-hmm. And we require, by the way.
We require
two extra years of language for our students, and they have to master a particular part of the world, and we expect them to study abroad.
Okay.
So we do build in area studies into global studies.
Because I would regret very much if we moved away from an emphasis on language.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we're sending a student to China to run a bank. He should be able to talk. It's not just the English speaking. Mm-hmm. Now, in India is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know an Indian language because everybody's bilingual wherever you go.
And yet it helps. You know, if people think that you're trying to learn their language, even though their English is far superior than our Hindi will ever be, still that it's an indication of kind of interest and an attempt to try to get inside their culture.
I'll tell you an example. Yeah. Mrs. Gandhi was here visiting a president who I will not name. And Mrs. Gandhi turned and said to one of her people in Hindi, how much longer do I have to talk to this fellow? Now, this was told me by an Indian who was present. And he said, you know, if your people had known what she said, it would have made a difference in the whole relationship.
Right.
To warn Americans that Mrs. Gandhi's smile.
Behind it, there was an iron will.
An iron will. No, I think it would be a great mistake if we move away from culture. Uh-huh. Now, Hindu nationalism is another thing. Mm-hmm. People think, Hindu must be about religion.
Mm-hmm.
I know many Hindu nationalists. I've never met one interested in you call religion.
The interior
studies.
Spiritual path. They are interested in culture and defending.
They're interested in culture. Mm-hmm. We're interested in putting down the Muslims and the Christians.
Yeah, so that's the other agenda.
That is the other side of it. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me, unless your global studies includes the cultural emphasis, the meaning of nationalism, Now,
well, that's a very good point. I mean, you would miss so much of the importance of the BJP if you didn't understand
that. Mm-hmm. the relationship, what we call religion, mm-hmm. and nationalism.
Do you think the BJP is just a, you know, a temporary blip, or do you think that kind of religious politics can rise again in India?
Many of my Indian friends say it is rising again. Mm-hmm. They think, for example, Gujarat, where it has an extreme internationalist government, that will become a very important factor in the election mm-hmm. next spring. Mm-hmm. Though that this is, again, Hindu nationalism can also have the color of being anti-Pakistan, mm-hmm. also pleasing the American administration mm-hmm. by being anti-Muslim terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that if I were teaching global studies, mm-hmm. I'd want students to know something mm-hmm. about what's involved in nationalism is no longer fashionable. Right. No colleges any longer teach courses on nationalism.
Right.
But Indian nationalism is, I would call it, we have to say Hindu nationalism, but it's cultural. Mm-hmm. Indians say, these Christians, these Muslims don't belong to our culture. Mm. Same as the French mm. are inclined to say.
Yes.
About people who wear headscarves.
Right. They don't our people.
Our people.
And so you were in India. You just went there a couple months ago
yeah.
At a young age of, dare I say, 87 years old?
87, yes.
Yeah. And you first went to India when you
I was 27.
You were 27. So that's, oh my Lord, that's 60-year span.
A young Indian said to me the other day, you knew my grandfather. I said, I knew your great-grandfather.
Well, I know this is going to be a stupid question, but how has it changed in those 60 years? I mean, what was India like? If you were just trying to boil it down into a few little examples, the difference between the India of 60 years ago and the India that you saw a couple months ago when you were...
For example, the India I saw when I first went to Delhi, we went out to one of the great monuments of India, Qutub Minar. Yeah. It took us 2 hours by the... By horse-drawn vehicle.
Right.
You drive out that direction now, it's solidly high-rise. You went to what was a village, mm-hmm. Gurgaon, on the mm-hmm. outskirts of Delhi.
Oh, and that's a big industrial center.
It's filled with what we would call skyscrapers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's just changed completely. However...
But those are physical changes.
Those are physical changes, but it also mm-hmm. reflects the kind of young people who are working there. Mm-hmm. All...
The rise of the middle class.
Rise of the middle class. Mm-hmm. Prosperous middle class. Mm-hmm. I also went down to other area I know very well, Madhya Pradesh. Mm-hmm. The villages have changed. Mm-hmm. Every village has electricity.
Uh-huh.
Not a village in India would have had electricity 60 years ago.
And cell phones.
And cell phones. Now, people would have laughed at you 60 years ago if you had gone into a village and said, may I use your telephone? There were no telephones.
No telephones.
No electricity.
Right.
No running water.
Yeah.
Whole different. That is changed, no
yeah.
question.
Right.
However, the poverty that, you know, the figures don't mean much. They're supposed to be a middle class. Middle class meaning people who can have radios, television, all the modern world.
Yeah.
There are probably 300 million in that group. That's a lot of people.
Yes.
More than middle class in this country.
Right.
But there's still 500 million people, and again, met Professor Mahanti, I asked him, would he agree with the figure? There's still 500 million people who are below the poverty level.
Hmm.
Now, that is what, when we talk about nuclear deals, and
right.
that our people miss, and where I hope in globalization...
Well, in this development of an Indian middle class, obviously it's changed people in terms of affluence and their ability to be in contact with the rest of the world. But, are there any fundamental changes in terms of culture and attitudes towards life, traditions of caste and religion and communal associations? Some things endure, don't they, regardless of the shifts in economic situation or technological? After all, simply to have a cell phone means that you can talk with more people at almost any time. It doesn't really mean you're going to talk differently with people or that you'll talk with different people, does it?
The Indian ambassador asked me the question you just asked me the other day.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how to
that I'd been there 60 years ago.
Right.
He asked me about the changes.
Right.
And I told him the changes that I've just told you, what globalization has meant in India.
Right.
He said, but you know also something about our culture. Do you have any regrets? And then he went on to say, I have regrets. This is a very modern Indian ambassador.
But what are your regrets about what? What do you think he meant?
The changes.
Huh.
The vulgarity of modern life. Mm-hmm. Cell phones. Mm-hmm. All right, cell phones are good things. But what does it do to village life, the relationship with your neighbors? Mm-hmm. It means you have another set of neighbors. Community life may be disappearing. In the sense that was so much at the heart of Indian life. Family life may be disappearing.
But
relationship of...
Do soldiers still marry in your caste? Isn't marriage is still arranged? Isn't family still important and all those things?
A good child still marries the way the parents want.
Right.
Not all of them, but
right.
good, obedient children do. They still follow the career.
Right.
But that is... not change. I think also spirituality, I don't quite know what the word means, but you can still have a talk about religion or whatever you want to call it with almost anyone in India, including Indian businessmen, who will be sincere in the discussion. I think that may disappear, but it hasn't so far. India is still a country that's profoundly influenced by religion, whichever religion it is.
And all of the mobility of globalization and people's ability to go to cities, ability to go to different parts of the world, must certainly affect some aspects of traditional social relationships.
It affects a great deal.
Uh-huh.
The fact that there are 2 million people of Indian origin in this country has had an enormous influence in India itself, on Indian politics.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this is not unusual to India. This is a part of the corruption of social relations throughout the world and in different ways and profound social changes, which really brings us back to the topic that we began the whole discussion with, that increasingly, if this is the case, dare I say, and I'm sort of making an advertisement or an argument for my own field of global studies, which we've tried to develop in Santa Barbara, maybe area studies is now best understood in a global context.
I agree with you wholly, yes. Mm-hmm. But there again, I mean, this whole business of the change that's taking place, I think it's very important as you do global studies, look at the country, India, China, and so on. And global studies is not going to make Chinese culture disappear or Indian culture disappear. And our people who are running things in this country are not aware of this. They're not aware that these Chinese high diplomats they meet, that these people underneath are profoundly Chinese. Mm-hmm. They're not globalized way down. Mm-hmm. That's true of India, too. Now, that I hope you'll include... I think global studies are terribly important. I'd be glad to see them replace area studies or whatever we used to call it.
But somehow as the world becomes more, we become more the same, we also stay profoundly in many ways very different.
Yes. I asked a young man in your class, and no, it wasn't your class, Guru Singh, about marriage.
Right.
He rather embarrassedly admitted that he wouldn't mind his parents choosing a wife for him. Uh-huh.
Even though he was an American of Indian background, he grew up here.
Spoke with an American accent.
Right.
Now, I think you have to take that in consideration. Mm-hmm.
Aisley, you've been a profoundly wonderful discussant, and we've been enriched by your knowledge, and we've been fascinated with your past.
I've been enriched by Santa Barbara.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.